Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, the targeted hit on an attorney deepens the crisis of whistleblower safety in South Africa. Nedlac's 88% success rate, but can social dialogue deliver real change? Trillions in wealth shifting to younger South Africans. Is the next generation ready? And robotics and automation set to dominate the Singularity SA Summit. It's Monday, the 8th of September. South Africa's legal and anti-corruption community is reeling today after the brazen assassination of insolvency attorney Boer van Niekerk at his Johannesburg office. Just by way of background, he worked on a Gupta-linked insolvency case and also exposed major Ponzi schemes. And his murder follows a chilling pattern, the killing of whistleblowers and investigators like Babita Deckoran and Kluti Murray, with few arrests and little accountability. And the message to those who dare to take on corruption is unmistakable, it seems. Speak out and you may be silenced. I want to discuss what this means for whistleblowers and for the fight against corruption in South Africa. And a strong voice in this respect is Wayne Duvenage from the organization Undoing Tax Abuse. Wayne, do you think that as a result of this tragedy, South Africa is at the risk of normalizing political hits and assassinations just as part of our general corruption landscape? Hate putting the question to you, but it seems that.
Yeah, it would seem that way, very much so. One gets a sense that as these incidences continue and with very little accountability and convictions, I think there's a greater brazenness and an ability or an attitude of, we're not going to get caught. Let's take out our opponents. Let's take out people that are getting in the way of corruption. And this is a very, very serious matter. We need to really think seriously as a government and as the police and introducing specialized task teams. We need to have accountability here. This cannot become the norm, and it appears that it's becoming a serious problem.
A serious problem. And what do you think this climate of fear then means for the broader rule of law?
Well, it means that a rule of law is not worth the paper it's written on. If you can get away with this type of crime, it's going to happen more and more. We know that criminal syndicates have infiltrated many, many departments in government across the country at all levels. And if this is the way that the opponents to corruption are going to be treating those who are trying to fight it, they're going to become more brazen. They're going to realize that our criminal justice system is not able to manage and contain this. And that's a very, very serious matter. We see it now with whistleblowers who don't want to speak up. There's so much that's going wrong at the moment. And why would they want to speak up if they're putting their lives in danger? Not only their lives, their livelihoods. But when your life becomes in danger, that's serious.
And it also says something about the state's priorities when we have seen a remarkable lack of conviction in whistleblower killings.
Exactly. We've been saying this for some time, that we need capacity. We need to see results. If we're going to tackle this scourge and deal with the corruption that is becoming endemic, and it probably is now, then how do we tackle it without the resources, the skills, the systems, the cross-pollination of information that flows between the various entities like SARS, SIU, Hawks, and so forth? We've just had the National Anti-Corruption Advisory Council hand its own report over to the president to start tackling corruption seriously. And one of them is the capacitation of the criminal justice system. And for as long as it is not geared up to take on these individuals and entities who, by the way, are very sophisticated, We're never, this is going to become a bigger problem. So we really have a lot of work to do. And I don't know why, Jeremy, the president is not treating this as a disaster.
There's also another consequence, and it's the chilling effect that this is inevitably going to have on ordinary citizens, Wayne, who want to report wrongdoing. The conventional wisdom would suggest it's safer not to do anything at all, and with that comes its own set of unique problems.
Yeah, and with that, crime continues to grow. More and more brazenness, more money is lost to the system, service delivery suffers. So it has huge consequences for the country if we don't get on top of this and nip it in the bud now before it becomes too widespread. So there's a lot of work to do, but again, we keep coming back to it's got to come from the top. There has to be a mindset of corruption. And crime of this nature is now serious, and it needs to be tackled in a very different way. We've got good laws, we've got good structures, but they're useless if they're not capacitated to deal with these problems.
You talk about developing a mindset as far as anti-corruption is concerned. How do you start making sure that South African society more broadly starts to shift its thinking?
Well, you know, I think that South Africa's society at large has shifted its thinking. It is fed up with what it is seeing every single day. You don't, can't open your digital news or print media and have an expose of something that's gone seriously wrong. The fact that people are being assassinated that are getting in the way with it is making it even worse. But the mindset is there from a public point of view, from, you know, this whole social compact, citizens pay their taxes and we need the service delivery, but the service delivery around security and crime prevention is not there. Government is dropping the ball, and the mindset about dealing with this seriously has to come from the top. The president has to sit down with the various role players and capacitate, but not just throw money and people at the problem, do it systematically and properly, and we need to move fast. And that National Anti-Corruption Council's report is a good start, because it deals with whistleblowers as well. It deals with educating the public on how do we tackle corruption, but it also deals with potential corruption courts. It deals with so much that needs to happen when it comes to fighting the scourge.
When you talk about capacitation as far as this is concerned, and that is critical, there's been talk about a dedicated whistleblower protection fund or even a specialized agency. Where's your head in that respect?
Well, it's with regards to this anti-corruption council that put this report out. They're talking about a section, chapter 9 institution, which has its own powers, reporting directly to parliament, and it has funds to do so, and it introduces whistleblower protections. There's quite a number of initiatives. The problem is that those plans are just ideas until they're able to be implemented. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, you can't go and set up another whole set of plans when we've got good institutions right now. The NPA, the Investigating Directorate, SARS, they all need funds to build their capacity to take on the criminal syndicates, and they can do it, but they can't do it without those funds. So, you know, I've always said, you give 10 billion rand to the criminal justice system, if spent wisely, and you get a return potentially of 100 billion rand, a good return on investment for the country. So why is the NPA and the Hawks and SIU, for that matter, and SARS, why are they so cash-strapped and bound by not getting these funds from Treasury? I know we cash-strapped as Treasury, but put the money and invest it in these areas where we need it, and we'll get that return.
Wayne Duvenage, thank you very much indeed, from the organization Undoing Tax Abuse.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's social dialogue body, NEDLAC, has just presented its annual performance review at its 30th summit, highlighting both successes and stubborn challenges that remain in our economy and our labor market. The executive director, Makuku Mampuru, joins me now. And I guess the key question is whether NEDLAC's achievements are truly making a difference for ordinary South Africans. Mr. Mampuru, a very warm welcome to you. You report an 88% success rate. That's impressive. But maybe I should ask you how that translates into real impact for unemployed South Africans who, as we all know, are facing daily hardship.
Thank you, Jeremy, and good day to you and your listeners. The performance of NEDLAC is at 88%, as you said, in the past year, because we have managed to process all that which we needed to process. The achievements or the non-achievements that account for the 2%, the 12% that we didn't do, are two mainly institutional internal issues. At the client-facing level, we have processed in excess of 17 policies and bills. Then, in addition to that, we have had dialogues. Now, I had to answer the question about whether dialogue is sufficient for people to taste on the ground. And my answer was, what do you do if you don't have a dialogue? You have situations like you have in the Middle East, in Sudan, in Ukraine. Once people stop talking, it leads to, and those are extreme cases. The immediate cases for us, what we have discussed in the past year, include the integrated resource plan that's got to do with electricity, and as a result of which, we are beginning to see the levels of load shedding going down. We have had discussions on regulation of tobacco. It has not been an easy discussion. We have had discussions on the improvements to local government. So the impact will be felt over a period of time. Some of it immediate, some of it over a period of time.
Isn't that part of the problem, though? Is the dialogue moving the needle quickly enough on jobs and growth?
I don't know about quickly enough, but there are certain discussions that tend to have an impact immediately. But for the most part, and as is the nature with legislation making, with policy making, it's usually over a period of time that we start to see and feeling an impact.
But we could be moving a lot quicker in that respect, don't you? A lot of ordinary South Africans are feeling the economic pinch more and more these days.
You remember, we are the social dialogue institution. The implementation and the impact gets felt in other spaces, whether it is in government departments, whether it is in society itself, whether it is by operations of business, whether it's by operations of communities. So what we do, we unlock whatever points of difference may be there in society. Everything that's got socioeconomic implications for society comes to us. Where there are points of difference, we engage all those. For example, through our Section 77 processes, through our labor market chamber discussions, we are able to recognize a reduced loss of man days because employers and employee organizations are able to find each other instead of resorting to the streets, resorting to lockouts. So yes, it may not be immediate, it may not be in your face, but eventually it does come to a point where the people, the intended recipients, feel a lot better, get to experience life a lot better than had been the case if there had not been those social dialogue exchanges.
Mr. Mapuru, is it becoming more difficult, do you think, to reach that consensus, given that we are living in such contestable times at the moment? How would you describe the nature of discussion and conversation within the NEDLAC grouping itself right now? It's become more difficult, surely.
Sometimes it's difficult, sometimes it's easy. Let me cite two examples. Some of the most difficult discussions had to do, I've already cited the tobacco bill, which has to do with the regulation of tobacco and electronic systems. It wasn't an easy discussion. We actually commended to Parliament a report that showed areas both of consensus and of difference. Many a times we go to Parliament and there's more areas of consensus than there are of difference. In this case, with tobacco, virtually all parties maintained their views, and Parliament will still have to process that. And then, of course, we have situations like the tariffs, the Trump tariffs. There, the social partners are all in agreement. They want to see the economy of South Africa perform better. They want to see a competitive agricultural sector. They want to see all aspects of tariffs that do not impact negatively on jobs, on the economy, on performance. So you have situations where you would have thought this would be difficult to facilitate, but then, surprise, surprise, it brings people together. And then other instances, because you would have thought that tobacco is harmful, there could be more support for the legislation. And then it becomes a little difficult because there are economic considerations for those involved in the tobacco business. So it cuts both ways, Jeremy.
I understand that, but I'd also suggest to you that coalition politics within the broader South African framework these days is making consensus very fragile. Is it more difficult for NEDLAC to keep authority and relevance in what many would say is a fractured environment?
Coalition politics are uniquely South African, aren't they? In 1994, we had coalition politics, even though the election outcome didn't necessitate coalition politics. And now the election outcome necessitated coalition politics. So, yeah, that I would leave to politicians. But I think the irony of the observation you are making is that the more fraught the relationships are, the more we are noticing at NEDLAC that all the social partners require each other. I don't think anyone wants to drive South Africa to the brink of collapse. I see that every day in the manner that the social partners interact at NEDLAC. Outside of NEDLAC, they may differ. In fact, they may go into discussions with what appears to be set positions that are unnegotiable. But when they come out of there, you can tell that everyone wants to see a South Africa that will succeed.
Just a final question. 30 years of social dialogue, yet unemployment and inequality in South Africa are still very much entrenched. Do you think that NEDLAC maybe has been a little too cautious?
My view on that is that NEDLAC has a role that is limited when it comes to implementation, to monitoring and evaluation. So to spin the question on you, so if we need that NEDLAC to be a lot more involved, maybe the starting point is to review its legislation. But when you review its legislation and you want to give it enforcement powers, whose powers do you want to take? Do you want to take the powers of the National Treasury? Do you want to take the powers of the Accountant and Auditor General? Do you want to take the powers of the Department of Trade and Industry, of Economic Development? So our system is such that at every level of state, everyone has got a role. So the real question is, those who are supposed to then implement the policies and the legislation that has come through NEDLAC, what is it that's making it difficult for them to realize the decisions that NEDLAC would have facilitated? So that's how I would see it. We think we are doing a great job at that which we are primarily established for, which is a preeminent organization for social dialogue. That we do very well. We hand over our reports to those parties that we should turn them over to, and it is entirely up to those parties to then see to their implementation.
The executive director of NEDLAC is Makuku Mampuru. Thank you very much for talking to me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, over the next two decades, trillions of rands in assets are going to move from retiring baby boomers to their children and their grandchildren. It is a transfer of wealth that could reshape how South Africans live, spend, and invest. But are families, advisors, and institutions ready for the emotional and often financial complexity that this big shift brings? Well, joining me to discuss the opportunities and risks of what's being termed the Great Wealth Transfer is Razik Christians, who's Executive Head Retail Distribution at PPS Investments. Razik, a very warm welcome, and I'm fascinated with the scale. Let's start there. How big is this transfer of wealth, and what does it actually mean for the country's economy?
Jeremy, thank you very much for having me. Firstly, yes, it's mind-boggling when we start looking at the amount of zeros. And globally, they talk about $100 trillion worth of wealth that's transferring through the different generations. In South Africa, I think we are definitely looking at massive amounts of money that's actually going to be moving, definitely billions by far. And the worrying part, obviously, is are our next generations ready to be able to handle this wealth transfer, and what's the kind of advice that they are getting at the moment to be able to help them sustain that transfer?
So it's the greatest risk isn't the money itself, but you're suggesting it's the lack of preparedness among those inheriting it. What are they missing out on? Why are they not prepared, and how should they be prepared?
One of the big things that lead in our younger generations are the fact that they look at how to invest very differently to our older generations. It's not just about returns, for example, which is generally the older cohort and their focus. It seems to be a lot more about what kind of expectation they get from a servicing point of view, what values-driven based investing, what purpose is coming through from how we actually put money away and how we invest money. I think that's a new way of looking at return-based investing, not just from the actual age groups, but also from what they expect from the relationship they have with an advisor, providing them with the right kind of advice. It's a very nuanced way of being able to deal with this new generation and how they seem to expect a relationship with an advisor to actually happen as well.
And that's such an important point, Razik, that you raise, because advisors need to build trust with younger clients. And I'd suggest they often feel very disconnected from the financial professionals that their parents have used. How do you bridge that gap, do you think?
100%. I think firstly, we need to understand how wealth transfers from through the generations. And before we even get to the younger cohort, I mean, we do need to also realize that family units should be investing or should be looking at an investment from a collective basis. So if an advisor should be actually managing the relationship, not just traditionally, you know, just the husband, but should be looking at the wife as well and then the children and bringing them into the conversation so that when something actually does happen, that all the relevant parties are actually aware of, firstly, how to be able to handle the relationship. More importantly, know who to speak to when it comes to how these different transfer moments happen during time, and then be able to help them with what is the correct way to be able to actually make sure that that wealth is going to be sustainable for all of them long term. Because that's the worst thing you'd want to do is inherit all of this wealth and just let it fall through your hands at the end of the day because of poor advice.
I'm so glad you raised that point, because retirement for many people often stretches 30 years or more. In your experience, then, what's the biggest mistake that people are making in planning for longevity?
We have a slightly nuanced approach here at PPS. And the reason why is that we focus on a particular cohort. Now, as a mutual business, we focus on the graduate professionals. And what we've actually realized in our data and our research is that our professionals tend to live even longer than the average South African, which is generally categorized around about 30 years. So they tend to live about 10 years longer, which makes that longevity problem even worse. Mm. So being able to really structure the way in which you're going to retire, and let's be honest, Jeremy, retirement today is very different compared to, for example, when my mother retired. It's a little bit nuanced. It's not I work for 30 years at one company and then I retire, sit at home for a few years and pass away. People are going to have a very dynamic way of looking at how they actually go about retirement. We have some people wanting to focus on finishing up their traditional role a little earlier and consulting. You have others that potentially want to work for a lot longer. And how you save throughout that journey during your accumulation phase becomes extremely nuanced and personalized to your circumstances. And being aligned with your advisor to be able to give you the appropriate advice for your particular situation becomes the only way you actually get to a space where you can retire successfully. Be able to really manage those potential 40 years after you hit something like 60, 65, which on itself is scary.
It's astonishing. I mean, that stretch is quite amazing. Razik, women are expected to control more wealth, and your research also shows that most widows change advisors within a year. What does that say about the industry's approach, and what needs to change, do you think?
Definitely. That's probably one of the scariest stats I've ever seen. I think it's 70% of widows actually fire their husband's financial advisor, if I can put it that way, purely because of no relationship. And it means that the onus, I believe, is on our financial advisors to ensure that when you are speaking to the family unit, you are incorporating both husband and wife. Both spouses need to be fully aware of what's happening so that as the advisor itself, you are able to grow along with that wealth as it transfers through generation to generation. And from a female perspective, when we look at our book from a PPS investments point of view, we see that predominantly we have lots of males, I suppose, that are in the retirement process at the moment. But if we drop through and actually look to who the beneficiaries are on those very investments, then we're talking about a cohort of about 80% females. Now, when you're looking at that bigger cohort that's going to be either that are themselves retiring or inheriting wealth, then the focus being placed on our female cohort at the moment is actually quite poor. And I think that's where our industry really needs to drive lots of change, to be able to incorporate those needs, make sure that they are comfortable and understand what the different processes are, and taken seriously in that regard as well, because there are many stats. I mean, females are making a lot more decisions in the household at the moment. And I joke and I tell people, listen, we're not talking about, you know, what the shopping list is. We're talking about actual financial decisions within marriages. I mean, that dynamic has shifted quite drastically. And I fear that as an industry, if we don't accommodate those changes, then ultimately the advisors are going to be the ones losing out, because you need to be the front runner in that space to accommodate for the needs of what the actual investors have.
Razik, just for the record, Mrs. Maggs makes all the decisions in our house, and I have her permission to say that. I'm going to leave it there. That's Razik Christians, executive of retail distribution at PPS Investments. Some sage advice there. Thank you so much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the countdown is well and truly on the way to the Singularity South Africa Summit 2025 set for the Sandton Convention Centre this October. It promises to bring global and local thinkers together to explore how exponential technologies like artificial intelligence, robotics, biotech and energy are reshaping business, education and society, and perhaps most importantly, what it means for Africa's future and its economy. Joining me now is Mick Mann, Co-Chief Executive Officer of Singularity South Africa. Mick, a very warm welcome to you. Your company talks about future-proofing Africa. What does that mean in practical terms for business leaders right now?
You know, we've been on a mission. It's our 10th year now with Singularity University to really, how do we educate, empower, and inspire the people of South Africa to enable them to create the products of the future, to lead in the future, so that we're not left behind and chasing this tale of disruption. And the theme for us for this year is to ignite Africa's future, you know, to create that spark of energy, momentum, and collective action needed to, you know, by embracing these exponential technologies, so that it can forge a bold, inclusive, and future-ready Africa together.
Mick, we really are on the cusp of a very interesting debate, and particularly when it comes to artificial intelligence. And I think the adoption often divides opinion. Some see huge efficiency gains, others predictably fear job losses. I guess the challenge, and something you will discuss at this conference, is persuading skeptics that benefits in the medium to long term will outweigh the risks.
Absolutely. I mean, well, it's a very delicate road we're on. And, you know, Ray Kurzweil predicts we're going to see more change in the next 5 to 10 years than we've seen in the last 100 years. So a lot of that is being propelled by these exponential technologies like artificial intelligence. And we have to embrace these tools and use them so that we can get ahead and create the new products and services of the future. It's not, you know, it's not going to be, you know, in AI, there's a big risk of job loss, but it's going to be the people using AI to empower themselves that are going to be the leaders in the future and create and have those jobs.
And Mick, that more change phrase that you use and the upward curve is fascinating. In fact, you suggest that this may be the last generation, I guess you and me included, to learn the old way. What do you mean by that? And what role then do you see AI playing in reinventing the entire system of education across the continent?
From the Industrial Revolution, the education system has been a very staple and, you know, set structure, where now, using artificial intelligence, we're seeing all new types of learning and individual learning. And there's schools that are coming out where students are learning with ARs on iPads and tablets and things like that for, you know, 2 hours of individual learning, where the AI can assess their strengths, their weaknesses, diagnose them, and, you know, help them learn much quicker and, you know, in a much more powerful way. And then they would spend the rest of the day working in teams and learning collaboration and critical thinking and creativity. So, you know, what we've already seen, what we're doing with AI is phenomenal. You know, we're creating new types of content and new types of creative that would cost normally millions of dollars to create at a fraction of the price. So the old way of learning is being disrupted, and we need, you know, for us, it's really important to try to get that across to the leaders that come to the summit. And we've got, you know, a large contingent of students that we've actually given bursaries to attend the summit this year in the metaverse, so that they can understand what's coming, learn from some of these incredible minds, and be leaders in the future.
And to that point about bursaries, I'm glad you brought it up, because it's critical that we prevent AI and robotics from deepening inequality. The problem, or the perception often, is it's only the wealthy that's going to be able to access the best tech and training, and that can't be.
Definitely. I mean, I think the big thing is that we need to democratize access. We need to give everyone these tools that are available at a fraction of the price of what they used to be, so that they can rise up and they can create the new products that we all want to use, instead of just a few handling it. You know, now you've got it, even with your cell phone and these new LLMs that are coming out that can run at, you know, at a much cheaper price, enable somebody to make extraordinary developments with these tools.
Mick, I can't not ask you about Maximus, apparently a humanoid robot, and I also read his robotic canine team. It sounds fascinating, but maybe more seriously, beyond spectacle, there's obviously a deeper lesson that demonstrations like this are meant to deliver.
Yeah, so we're very excited to be bringing Maximus, the humanoid robot, and exactly two other canine friends that have got vision and can do certain tasks. If you think about the physical workforce, as AI is being imbued and embodied into hardware, it's now going to change the structure of physical jobs, because these AIs, I just saw yesterday a robot packing laundry for somebody. So now these robots are going to really disrupt the status quo, and we're going to have hundreds of millions of robots in our world in the future. I've seen other robots that help carry the shopping for the elderly, or for, you know, if you're lonely, you can have a robot companion. And even besides robots, you're going to have AI companions. I've got a friend that can't go to sleep at night without chatting to her ChatGPT for just advice on her day and her next day coming. So it's really important for us to embrace these new tools, create these new products using these tools, so that we aren't left behind in this new wave.
Providing we embracing them responsibly. And back to robotics, there's no doubt that they are going to play a major role in the future in threatening and disrupting industries and everything from mining to healthcare. And critical, and I'm assuming this will come out at the summit, that leaders balance this exciting innovation with protecting livelihoods. That's always got to be delicately handled.
Yeah, like I think these robots, they don't get, you know, they, as long as they've got power, they don't stop working. When they get to a low battery state, they can go and self-charge. So they can inspect, manufacturing plants, or looking at stock takes or logistics in the logistics industry. It's really going to span across multiple industries. I've got friends in India. I've just come back from the Singularity India Summit, where they had a robot that has been built for the elderly, to keep the elderly, to look after the elderly, and also to keep them company as a companion.
Just a final one. Big ideas, as you've outlined to me, are inspiring. But Mick, very quickly, what concrete takeaways do you want delegates to leave with that they can apply in their businesses from the get-go?
So we really want people to understand the immense power of these different exponential technologies, and to be able to take action within their own businesses. I mean, if you're not using artificial intelligence, if you're not thinking about a post-AGI world, once we reach super intelligence, everything is about to change. And people are going to be left with the mindset and the skill set to take action in their own businesses, in their own lives. And we've seen this over the years. This is our 10-year anniversary. We've seen so many people change their careers or update their businesses, scale their businesses to new heights, so that, you know, we can, from South Africa, empower the world and empower our people and our nations.
All about the Singularity South Africa Summit 2025, set for the Sandton Convention Center this October. I've been in conversation with Mick Mann, Co-Chief Executive Officer of Singularity South Africa. Mick, sounds very exciting, and thank you very much. And that is where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.